I love the fact that Clotilde brought us to church. I think I still can call myself a young man. Because when I was in South Africa when I was 28 years old, they told us that until we turned 46, we were part of the global youth. We weren't elders, and so I'm going to hold on for the next few weeks. I was raised in New York City in a black, by way of a black Baptist church storefront. My mother and father both are from Haiti. My late father deceased. My mother came to the United States in 1965, and I often mention my mom. My mom's 79 years old, and she saw one of my speeches. I gave a talk on Dr. King at Chautauqua Institute last month, and she texted me and she said she saw something online. She saw something. She said, "You know, baby," she's texting me, and it's so interesting to text with your mom. I used to call your mom, and I'm grandfathered into a whole different generation. I remember when there were busy signals.
Right.
I remember when phone calls were a dime. So I remember all that. And so she texts me and she says, I think the mic is a little, just some feedback. She texts me and she says, "You know, I'm so proud of you, honey. You're always mentioning your mom. You're always mentioning me in these talks." And I said, "Well, mom, the reason why I'm mentioning you is not only because I love you, but I wouldn't be a historian and I wouldn't be an activist if it weren't for you, right? So you always have to give, you always have to give deference to not only your parents, but to elders. And I think in a way what we're trying to do here today is give that deference to those whose shoulders we really stand upon. One of the things that sometimes we do is have generations speak past each other, where we have an older generation telling younger people their struggles, and they're doing it with the best interest at heart, but they're not necessarily connecting to the struggles that the younger people are facing. They're often very, very similar. That's why I said they're speaking past each other. So what I want to talk about today is 1968 and 2018, and really some of the lessons that we can learn as we're trying to move forward. And when we think about this year, 1968 is a year of revolutionary struggle for black citizenship. We live in an era where we're talking about diversity and multiculturalism, we're talking about inclusion, but what we're really talking about is a struggle for black equality and citizenship. And I want us to really understand that, and I want us to own that, and for people who are non-black in the room, I want people to understand that what Dr. King, what Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Clotilde, these precursors, what people were fighting for was black citizenship, but they were fighting for universal citizenship for all. Right. But they understood that the universal had to go through the particular. Wow. So when I say I study black power, I'm also studying women, I'm studying people who are LGBTQ, I'm studying Asian Americans, I'm studying Latinx folks, I'm studying people who are incarcerated and people who are elites, right? So when we think about this movement for black power, when we think about 1968, global 1968, it is a struggle for both, one, black citizenship, and that's, I want to talk a little bit about Dr. King and that struggle for black citizenship, but it's also a struggle for what Malcolm X called black dignity, okay? And when we think about that struggle for black dignity and black citizenship, I want to break it down. What they meant by that, what do we mean by it 50 years later? And for people who want to be allies, remember when Black Lives Matter came out, there's some people who said, "Well, all lives matter," right? And it's like, well, no. Black lives is saying all lives matter. It's a realization that the lowest common denominator, the lowest economic political rung in the United States, the people who are always overly represented on the worst social economic indicators and underrepresented on the positive social economic indicators are black folks. And not just African American, I mean black folks, global black folks.
Yeah.
Whether you're from Haiti or St. Lucia or Nigeria, or whether you're biracial or multiracial, if you identify as being part of that African diaspora, right? And really, that diaspora is connected to the third world, the Bandung world, right? And so when we think about 1968, what's so important for us 50 years ago is that 50 years ago, we were on the cusp of a political and social and cultural and economic revolution. Don't let anybody fool you and think and make you think that 1968, Dr. King, Black Panthers, political assassinations, all these things happened, but there was no way a revolution was going to happen. Not true. Not true. We've got, through the Freedom of Information Act, the State Department files, the FBI files, we've got the stuff that they've released. On Stokely Carmichael alone, I went through over 20,000 pages of files on just trying to stop Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, trying to stop Angela Davis, trying to stop Kathleen Cleaver, trying to stop black student activists like the ones we have here who are at places like UT, at historically black colleges. They were at City College, they were at San Francisco State, and they were trying to foment for what? This struggle for black dignity and this struggle for black citizenship. And to do that, they combated institutions of white supremacy that had a stranglehold on American democracy at the local, regional, national, and global level. UT's story is just one part of a panoramic global story for citizenship and dignity. And how did these activists define this? I'm still getting feedback, Jason. These activists defined this struggle for black dignity as more than just the right to vote, and more than just what Ella Baker called the right to have a hamburger at an integrated Woolworths lunch counter. They were talking about environmental racism. They were talking about reforming the criminal justice system. They were talking about food justice. Big exotic thing among our contemporary students, environmentalists, is saying, hey, food justice. Well, guess what? Guess what? Harriet Tubman was talking about food justice. Wow. Frederick Douglass was talking about food justice, right? When you read Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, she's talking about food justice, right? So food justice has always been at the core of the African-American freedom struggle, or the black freedom struggle, black liberation struggle. Criminal justice reform, way before Michelle Alexander comes out with the new Jim Crow, Malcolm X and Nation of Islam are saying that there's something wrong with the criminal justice system and prisons in the United States of America. And way before then, there were black activists saying that, right? And so when we think about this movement, this struggle for social justice in 1968, this is an important we have to give it context. We have to say, what was so important, and why was this a tipping point in 1968, and why was it so threatening to the status quo, so threatening to not only institutionally racist institutions in American democracy, but millions of white citizens, to the point where people are protesting at the Democratic National Convention, the police are brutalizing and physically assaulting nonviolent demonstrators in August of 1968. Demonstrators, their slogan is "the whole world is watching." And the reason why they say "the whole world is watching" is because they're saying there's a dramatic gulf between American democratic rhetoric and its reality. And 50 years later, we still have a dramatic gulf between American democratic rhetoric and reality, right? But one of the things we do is we continue to embrace myths and lies about American democracy and American history. And even, again, our language. We talk about multiculturalism and diversity when this has always been about why, in a country that is based on freedom and democracy and liberty, why is the core of that country racial slavery? And the way in which racial slavery built up global capitalism based on the exploitation and the destruction of black bodies in perpetuity, perpetually. This hasn't stopped. And the reason why black people continue to scream and shout is because it hasn't stopped. Yeah. Malcolm X in 1964 said that black people were angry, and he said, "I'm the angriest." The reason he said that was about the political and social and economic marginalization and exploitation that was happening to the black community. By 1965, Dr. King is on board. In the aftermath of Watts, what Dr. King is talking about is a radical redistribution of wealth. King is against militarism, materialism, and racism, right? King is no longer on speaking terms by 67 with Lyndon Johnson, with President Johnson. They used to be friends. They were buddies, right? But by 1967, no more. Why? Because King is saying the war on poverty is not enough if you're spending 50 times more in Vietnam. Wow. We still live in a country where we're spending billions and billions of dollars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've got black people and poor people dying on the streets of all these cities, including right here in Austin, right? We've got a mental health crisis. We've got a health care crisis. We've got an HIV and AIDS crisis. We've got an environmental racism crisis that goes beyond Flint, Michigan. People were talking about all of this in 1968. When you think about Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign, the reason it's a revolutionary, nonviolent movement is that King is trying to reprioritize the nation and the world strategy against the nation's will. When King says he's gonna bring an army of the poor to Washington, D.C. in early 1968, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Time Magazine say that he is crazy and that he's gonna foment violence by bringing nonviolent poor people to Washington, D.C. That's what they say. They say, how can you bring these poor people to Washington, D.C.? That's not civil rights. How can you speak out against the Vietnam War, they tell him? That's not civil rights. He says, well, yeah, it's human rights, but why are you tripping, right? And so when you think about what's going on in 68 is gonna be a revolutionary era where black people are trying to redefine citizenship in American democracy, but all these other groups are coming along. Black people have always been at the cutting edge of radical democratic movements, right? Not because we are so special, but because we've always been at the bottom of the rung. We're what Derrick Bell called the faces at the bottom of the well, right? So Latinos join, Asian Americans, Native Americans, white allies, LGBTQ, people who are non-able-bodied, they've all joined, but black people have always been pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And we see this with the Black Lives Matter movement. The BLM movement is saying the core of the black freedom struggle, the core of a struggle for democracy, should be the most marginalized people within that black community, including the poor, including young people, including elderly, including people who need mental health, right? We have millions of people who need mental health, and what we do is have law enforcement and criminal justice system that's more willing to kill them and shoot them and incarcerate them and destroy them than to give them any kind of hope and any kind of access to opportunities where they can live a full life, right? And so when we think about 68, what's so important when we think about 1968 is the panoramic spectrum. And very briefly, I want to talk about 68 and the spectrum of activism that we have. So on one level, you've got Martin Luther King Jr. and a poor people's movement, but you also have black feminists who are organizing all across the country, in college, at universities, at local communities, connected to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Black Women's Liberation Committee. You also have student activists, including Clotilde and your cohort right here at UT, who are demanding not just black studies, but they're demanding full and equal access to housing, they're demanding good food, they're demanding an end to racist violence and assaults. And this should sound familiar because the echoes of 68 are all around us, right? In 2018, our students here, students of not just color, but black students and the students of color, often don't feel safe. We don't have full faculty representation here in terms of the African American community and communities of color. We don't have full student representation here. Everybody loves black athletes, they hate black bodies. So we love black athletes. We love it. We say, hey, run faster, jump higher. We love it. But LeBron James, we love the championship in Cleveland, but if you open up that school in Akron, people are saying he's getting too big for his britches, right? He's opening up that black school in Akron, we say he's out of pocket at this point, right? So when we think about where we're at from 68 to 2018, way before Colin Kaepernick, we had Muhammad Ali in 68. We had all these black athletes like Bill Russell and Jim Brown, and black women and men who were protesting against segregation. They were protesting against white supremacy, and many of them paid the price, losing endorsements. We had the University of Wyoming, the football team, players getting kicked off by 68, 69 for protesting. So sports and popular culture are a big part of this. Clotilde mentioned Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud by James Brown, but James Brown is really animating a larger expression of grassroots activism. Yeah. It was young people. When you think about both the young people who are in the audience today, but also the precursors who were really, really young in that context of 1968, they were the ones who were leading this. And the reason they were leading the charge is because they were struggling to try to transform American democracy. They were trying to transform these institutions that are supposed to be about uplift and opportunity and equality and fairness, but these are institutions that have been utilized to do what? To exploit and to really make sure that unequal power relations are maintained in American society. And right now, 50 years later, the opportunities that University of Texas at Austin could potentially offer black communities in the city of Austin is only barely being tapped into. Of course, we have Dr. Moore and what DDC is doing, but historically, we live in a city where black folks in Wheatsville were forced out of Wheatsville en masse by 1930 and 1931. The city plan fostered and promoted racial segregation and white supremacy. Yeah. Black people had to move on the east side in the 1930s, and you couldn't get plumbing, you couldn't get electricity, you couldn't get any infrastructure unless you moved there. I live in a neighborhood, Hyde Park, that was touting itself in 1929 and 1930 as an all-white community and proud of that, right? As a segregated community. And that's the history. Civil rights in burnt orange is that history that they're not telling you. We're planning a class in the center. We're gonna teach a class on civil rights just right here in Austin. And that story that every single undergraduate needs to know, which includes the precursors and includes what the city of Austin the black people. And the joke is on us because we go from being 15% of the population in Wheatsville in 1930 to being 1% in 1933, 1934. But the joke's on us because the east side gets gentrified, which means what? Negro removal. That's what they called urban renewal in the 1960s. They called it Negro removal, and we see it on the east side of Austin right now. And we've got a liberal mayor and a supposedly liberal city council that is doing nothing to stop this, right? Because you can stop it easy by saying, hey, the black folks who are historically on the east side and they can no longer pay the skyrocketing property taxes and their homes might be in disrepair, how come the city doesn't provide the money for that, right? So we can keep that neighborhood integrated, and we could actually have racial integration. The east side is getting all this investment right now, but black communities aren't having access to that investment. So we're getting new schools, you're getting new houses, you're getting a whole influx of capital, and at the same time, black people are moving where? Pflugerville? They're being pushed out. So the city of Austin has a whole lot to answer for when we think about 68 to 2018. Are you still with me? Because I still have a When we think about 1968, I want to briefly talk about the Black Panthers and compare them to the student activists that we have now and the young people like Black Lives Matter. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense is a group of political revolutionaries who always get a bad name and a bad rap as being fomenters of violence, right? Because they arm themselves, they patrol the police for a while. But the Panthers were really revolutionaries who were trying to bring consciousness to the institutional racism and the politics of the politics and practices of racial domination that were happening in the United States from Oakland all the way to the East Coast and places like Harlem. So what the Panthers did was they created survival programs, they created free breakfast programs, they created free busing to prison programs. They had a 20-point program, sometimes called a 10-point program, what we want and what we believe. They talked about an end to police brutality. They talked about housing. They talked about ending racial segregation. They talked about black history in schools. And they end, point number 10, it says, we want land, bread, peace, and justice, right? So what they were talking about was really a revolutionary human rights movement, but they were getting castigated and they were getting smeared as being promoters of violence. And one thing we have to understand with African American history, historically and contemporaneously, when black people protest and struggle and fight back, the first thing people say is, you're violent, okay? The first thing people say is that, hey, why are you so angry? The first thing people say is that, hey, why are you raising your voice? Well, you're raising your voice and you're so angry because you're out here dying. And you're trying to make sure that other generations can actually survive. And you're trying to speak truth to power like your ancestors did, right? So the reason why black people tend to shout, and remember Ralph Wiley had that book, Why Black People Tend to Shout, is because of institutional racism and the politics and practices of white supremacy. That's why they tend to shout, right? And we can even see this among our scholars and colleagues and different people, where they say, man, black people come in the room and they got all this energy. This excitement. You know what I mean? They're like, man, like what happened, you know? And the reason why we got that energy and that excitement and that rhythm is because of the history of our existence right here in the United States. In Texas, in Austin, in Oklahoma, in Oakland, in New Orleans, right? And globally, it's New Orleans to Nigeria. I always say Haiti to Harlem because I love them both, right? It's Brooklyn to Botswana, yeah. Right? And so when we think about 1968 and 2018, the Panthers and the precursors, that legacy is continued to be animated in the politics of Black Lives Matter, right? When we think about the BLM movement, we think about Trayvon Martin, we think about all the young women and men and boys and girls who've been murdered by the police. And I can say it. I mean, if you're unarmed and you get shot and you're killed, you've been murdered by the police, okay? And just because people are saying that legally they are not culpable, it doesn't mean morally they're not culpable, right? And so when we think about that Black Lives Matter movement, the reason that movement has been so important and powerful is that it's resting on the shoulders of this earlier movement, right? And this movement for Black Lives Matter has been what? It's been a movement that's talking about not just racial justice and economic justice, it's talking about the environment, it's talking about public policy, it's talking about small d democracy and voting rights. It's talking about transforming the American democratic experiment once and for all so it actually applies equally to all of its citizens, right? That's what we're talking about, right? So the legacy of 68, from 68 to 2018, is really important. And here are just 3 points I want to leave us all with. We're doing it here. UT, we've reached a kind of critical mass where we have Dr. Moore, we've got so many different, we've got Dr. Richard Reddick here, we've got so many different professors who are African American, who are black folks, who are people of color, who really are interested in social justice, really interested in racial justice. Many of them are some of the leading national voices on a whole host of issues that are connected to inequality, and we're trying to really build something here that both acknowledges the past, but puts that past in conversation with the present, and really leads us to a new vision for the future. Because at UT, we have so many different resources. If we are ever to achieve racial justice in the city of Austin, University of Texas has to be at the center of that. Right. It's got to be at the center of that. And that includes our sports, it includes our athletes, it includes our academics, it includes our staff, it includes our faculty. We can absolutely lead, right? But to lead, we have to be willing to have these courageous conversations. Toni Morrison says unspeakable, unspoken things. We've got to talk about racism, not one day of the week, every day of the week. We've got to talk about sexism, not one day of the week, but every day of the week. We've got to talk about homophobia, not one day of the week, every day of the week. We've got to talk about all these different forms of oppression that ensconce us in our existence every single day. But that struggle for black dignity and citizenship, and very quickly, before I end, what Dr. King defined citizenship as was a person having a living wage, having decent housing, having health care, food justice. He talked about child care when he met with welfare rights activists, right? So when we think about citizenship, the right of citizenship goes beyond this idea that there is no relationship between citizens and its government, right? Citizens have a relationship between themselves and their communities, but also federal, state, and local governments. All of us who have this access, who vote regularly, who have nice homes, who have children we send to schools that are safe, right? We are enacting our citizenship rights, but everyone should have that access. All of us who are eating these organic vegetables, right? You know, we're taking yoga classes, we're taking our significant others and we're getting massages and we're getting all these different things. We're seeing therapists. This is all beautiful. Everybody should have access. Everybody should have access. So what King talked about and what Malcolm X talked about in terms of that struggle for black dignity was a world, a society where being black, not only taking away the negative indicators of racial oppression, right, but also enjoying full and unfettered citizenship. Because we still live in a country where not all black people have voting rights. We still live in a country that is racially and economically segregated. The high point of racial integration in public schools, according to Gary Orfield, is 1988. Oh, wow. And after that, after the Supreme Court case, Milligan, it goes back again in the other direction to pre-Brown, right? So our neighborhood schools are segregated, and we have Ted Gordon on the school committee who's fighting against all that. We have residential segregation. The tipping point sociologists tell us when a community has African Americans in it is about 6-7%.
Wow.
And then people who can leave, they are running out of there, man. They're running out of there, right? So the only way we can transform the current situation that we're in, both in the city of Austin, but right here in this university, is to be honest enough to speak truth to power. The final three things: educate, organize, and agitate. What can we do? One, we've got to educate ourselves about this story. We have a great book here, and the center is going to do a program with Virginia Cumberbatch and others, As We Saw, which is a story of the precursors. We have to know our history. We have to know our history nationally, but we have to also know our history locally. All of our students, faculty and staff, need to know what the precursors went through.
That's right.
And we need to have a dialogue between the precursors, and we'll set this up too, and young people who are current students about what their experiences are. Because you're gonna find so many commonalities. And sometimes an older generation, including my mom, who I love dearly, they're not God, they don't know everything that happened. So my mom sometimes is like, wow, you know, Peniel, I didn't know it was still bad today in 2000, you know, like I went through a lot, but I thought, hey, you know, my son's a professor, everything's cool. And it's just like, man, the stories you're telling me, I'm reading your op-eds and reading your stuff. And young people here, man, they experience a lot. So they might not have the same Jim Crow signs that you face, right? But boy, people are experiencing real pain and trauma every day being at this university. And so we have to bridge that gap and have those conversations. So we have to be educated about our history, both locally but also nationally. All the students here, mass incarceration, the new Jim Crow, racial inequality, you have to understand the history of civil rights and think about where you fit in, whether you're Latinx, whether you're gay, you're straight, whatever you are, however you're identifying, right? Pronouns, right? However you're identifying, you have to know that history so you can fit in, and then what are you gonna do? Then you can agitate and organize. And when I say agitate, I'm all for a civil dialogue and a civil conversation in the United States. But until there is no more social injustice in the United States, until there is no more inequality, until there is no more discrimination at all levels, I'm talking about from the grassroots to corporate and business and banking, we have to agitate. We will not have the society and the world that we want to live in until we are fully informed and we are courageous enough to have these conversations. So we have to agitate. And finally, we have to organize. The legacy of 1968 is the way in which precursors and black student unions and black student activists organize, right? We think of that legacy through a popular culture lens and we say, man, I love the Afro that Angela Davis had and that now Colin Kaepernick had. These are symbols, and I love the Afros too. It's beyond that. It's beyond symbols. The substance of that period is that people were willing to speak truth to power and organize to try to transform American democracy for all of us. And remember, these folks are the patriots. These are the people who love America enough to criticize America. These are the people who represent the best of the nation. And they represent the best of the democratic experiment. When Dr. King, in 1963, in Letter from Birmingham Jail, he's in the Birmingham City Jail. When he writes that letter and he says that the young people who are being demonized, who are being arrested in Birmingham, some as young as 8, 9, 10, 11, over 1,100 of them, nonviolent demonstrators, arrested in 1963. He says that one day there's going to be a future generation that recognizes them as heroes. And he says that they're going to be recognized as heroes, and King's quote is, for bringing us all back to those great wells of democracy that were dug deep by the founding fathers. So King was saying, this protest that's being vilified now, we see it with Black Lives Matter protesters and March for Our Lives protesters and Me Too protesters and Women's March protesters and immigration rights protesters who are being arrested, they're being beaten, and they're being brutalized. Future generations, and we should recognize that now, are going to remember them as heroes. That these were the people on the cutting edge of a movement for not just civil rights, for human rights. A movement to transform American democracy and make this democracy what Dr. King said in his last speech, April 3rd, 1968, Wednesday evening in Memphis, Tennessee. What he said is, all we say to America is be true to what you put on paper. That's what he said, right? And he said, the greatness of America lies in the right to protest for right. Right? And King was being vilified as a radical, as a revolutionary, right? Remember, we don't embrace King until he's assassinated. Right? We have to always remember that.
Absolutely.
We don't embrace Martin Luther King, Dr. King, until he's assassinated. And even now, we embrace parts of the man and not the message. Right? Because the message is something that forces us all to look deep and think about. What kind of society and what kind of world are we trying to leave to our children, our grandchildren, or our great-grandchildren? So I want to leave you with a note of optimism. I'm very, very excited to be here today. I'm excited that you're all here today. I'm really excited about the future because so many people are active and are organizing. These are absolutely dark days when we think about what's going on with immigration, when we think about what's going on with the criminal justice system, when we think about what's going on with black poverty, in many ways, and there's a great book if people want to check it out, Monique Morris, Black Stats, which gives us the up-to-date stats. And there's another book, Latino Stats, gives us up-to-date stats on both blacks and Latinos. We are still horrifically overrepresented in all negative social economic indicators. And by that I mean everything from how long we live, our rates of cancer. Black women are dying of breast cancer and other diseases at disproportionate rates right now as we speak. Black men too, right? And we are still woefully underrepresented in positive social economic indicators. We're 12% of the population. We are 2% of meaningful positions in corporate America, for example, right? But, and here's the big but, people are recognizing and having a consciousness on really an unprecedented level about the situation we face. And I think it puts us in a great position to organize and organize for really a kind of world and society that we've never seen before, right? And that's what's so exciting about what so many different groups are coming together to talk about social and political justice and organize. Yes, we have to vote. We have to vote this November. We absolutely have to vote. The vote is one important part of constant and continuing activism and organization. We have to be represented based on our numbers at every single level in every institution in society. We've got to be the judges. We've got to be the school presidents. We've got to be the doctors, the lawyers. We've got to be in Silicon Valley. We are currently underrepresented in Silicon Valley. We are less than 2% of folks in Silicon Valley when we think about meaningful positions, right? But this gives us all food for thought in a way that we can actually think about the legacy of 1968 to 2018 as a continuation. We think about it as a continuation, that there's a new generation of people who are aligning with that older generation, who are thinking about how to transform American democracy, thinking about racial justice, and really, again, I'll leave us on this note. When we think about what we're talking about, we are talking about the struggle for black equality and how if we achieve that struggle, we are going to have a panoramic reverberating effect for all these different groups. That's what we're actually talking about. We're talking about black citizenship, black dignity, the struggle for, and that if we were to ever achieve that, all the issues of social and political and economic and cultural injustice that we see, we have a way of fixing and transforming. But that common denominator is black folks, because we live in a democracy, small r republic, that was founded on racial slavery. It tries to forget that every day in a way that black people can absolutely not forget every day. Right? All right, that's it. Thank you.